Well, good evening. Happy holidays, everyone. This is Steve, and I'm here tonight with two of my very best friends in the entire history of ever. Well, ladies first. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hello. I'm Andrew.
No, you're not.
I'm sure that's offensive on some level, but I'm here.
Oh, yeah. Well, on some level. But let's actually go ahead and let's scratch the entire episode now, and let's just talk about ways that Andrew is offensive.
Mm-hmm.
I made two lists of how Andrew is offensive. No, oh. That's actually for later. So, and we're also here tonight with...
Hi, I'm Casey.
Casey, yes. Like Casey Jr. going down the track. Are you guys familiar with who Casey Jr. is? Casey Jr.? Mm-hmm. He's a little circus train from Dumbo. And then you I think I can. You know, does sound familiar to you guys? No? Yeah.
Casey maybe? Is no. The little engine that could.
Casey Jr., but yes, it's the little engine that could, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I used to ride it at Disneyland because behind the Dumbo ride, they have the Casey Jr. ride and they have the monkey cage. And I always insisted on being in the monkey cage of the Casey Jr. ride. And then you come to this track and it goes, and then you hear over there, Casey Jr. Anyway. We're going to owe Disney money now because I sang like 45 seconds of the Casey Jr. song. And I have a feeling that Disney will probably hit us up for it because, man, are they losing money? Yeah, that's something else to talk about at some other time. Anyway, so what are we going to do tonight, guys? We're here tonight. What are we up to?
We're here to ring in the jolly good cheer of the holidays.
The holidays. Is there holly good cheer? Is it really holly good cheer? Because we were talking about gratitude culture, but we can come back to that in a bit. Actually, here's a fun story. Casey and I went to the ER for 10 hours. 10
yeah.
hours of at the ER, which was just magic.
It was a wonderful times. That was about 2 weeks ago or so.
Yeah, 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Well, because it's symptoms related to my eating disorder, and I just haven't been nourishing myself very well for a long time, and that has caused my body to like be shaking a lot, and it turned out that after they did the labs, they found out that I had low potassium because I'm dehydrated and underfed, and I'm losing weight because of my eating disorder.
Your eating disorder is quite a bit different than many that I've ever heard of in my life. And we hear about quite a few of them coming through the STS support groups, but how about yours? I mean, would you mind explaining what it is you deal with?
Other more common eating disorders you may have heard of are like anorexia or bulimia. But I when I was younger, I had anorexia, which is like you don't like the look of your body. You think that you look bigger than you really are. But that was not really my textbook case. I was always just underweight and always had a hard time gaining weight, getting to a normal weight for my age. But the newer diagnosed eating disorder that I'm dealing with is called ARFID, which stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. And for me, that means that I'm just very, very anxious about what food might do to my body. And it's just, in my case, I'm very paranoid that I might have digestive problems or bowel problems after I eat.
Well, cool. Let's talk about shit.
It's shit. Yes.
Let's talk about shit.
And that.
I mean, let's actually talk about poo right now.
It scares me because I always think that I'm going to get diarrhea, which is not fun for anybody.
Oh, I like it. I like feeling like a squid when I'm sitting on the toilet.
I don't like feeling dehydrated.
I like feeling like I'm an upside down geyser. So yeah, I don't, you know, speak for yourself. I like diarrhea.
I don't think anybody does, but
I love it.
Well, good for you. I don't want my consistency of my shit to be mud. That's what I think of it as. And I always fear that if I get diarrhea, then, oh my God, what wrong food did I eat today? Or did I drink too much liquid to make it so this consistency?
Yeah.
And I think different people have different takes on what really is diarrhea for themselves.
Well, let's go ahead and quantify the viscosity then. This is a great way to go. So I need something that's at least similar to 10W40 because I like to double up on the fluids that my body produces. So if I could use it to lubricate the vehicle as well, then, you know, bonus. So what viscosity do you like your diarrhea?
Isn't there an actual scale for this? I know for sure there is a scale of poop.
Yes. Okay, you got Google right there. Then you need to look it up. Look it up, Andrew. It's your fault for bringing it up.
There's a scale. It's like there is, I can't remember the name of it, but there is something.
The Bristol stool chart.
Yes. Very good. Yes.
Yes.
And there's different like shapes too. There's like different shapes or.
Like pebbly and yeah. Yeah. It's like an intermediate phase. Gravelly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gravelly?
Gravelly. It's got charts too. I mean, I could pull that up for you if you'd like. If you'd like to screen share please. The shit.
Yes, absolutely. I would, you know, I scrap the rest of the episode. I just really like to talk about the viscosity of shit that you guys don't want.
Yes. I mean, it's fascinating, really.
Beyond fascinating. Anyhow, so Andrew, come on, educate us.
All right. So as far as, you know, ranging from full-on constipation to full-on diarrhea, you've got your, you know, type 1, separate hard lumps, kind of like little nuts, very hard to pass, borderline constipation. Type 2, sausage-shaped, but very lumpy. Type 3 is like sausage, but with cracks on the surface. Type 4 is like sausage or a snake, but smooth and soft.
Oh.
And I'm sure you've experienced all of these. And going into number 5, we have soft blobs with clear-cut edges, passed very easily. And then you got type 6, which is going into diarrhea territory, fluffy pieces with ragged edges, overall a mushy stool. And finally, watery, no solid pieces, entirely liquid. That's the diarrhea zone.
And that's what I fear that I'm always going to get. And so I have what I call safe foods that I think will not cause what I think would be diarrhea. So I eat a lot of just like bread-based things. Or rice, or I mean, I'm not a vegetarian. I do eat meat, but I'm very, I guess you could say, scared or selective of how the meat is cooked. I want to make sure that the meat is cooked through enough so that I don't get sick. And so therefore might have an infection or get food poisoning or something.
So that rules out sushi, right?
That rules out sushi. Definitely.
Well, actually, I heard quite the opposite, that the more rare your meat, the less opportunity there is to have watery stool. I don't know which papers and documentation that what you're citing, but the more you cook it, the more you take a piece of steak and turn it into a cow scab, the more opportunity there is for you just to blow out your entire lower half of your abdomen because of it. So I think you're going the opposite direction. I think you're actually harming yourself by overcooking your meat rather than cooking it in a way that an American would actually enjoy.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, when I go to a steak restaurant, I usually ask for well done, but recently I've been trying different things. And so I've recently tried doing maybe medium well, or medium rare or medium well, but not well done, so that it's just a shade not as cooked as it could be.
Yeah, well, if you're going to do well done, I would recommend going down to the Circle K and getting yourself some jerky, because it's the equivalency.
I always get sick when I eat jerky. I don't like it.
Yeah.
It's too dry. It's too salty or something.
Yeah. Kind of like cooking a steak well done. Too dry. Too blecky. A cow scab. Effectively, you're ordering a cow scab. Anyway, so that is a original. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not original. It's an unusual for me. Until I met you, I had not heard of the avoidant, the anxiety and the avoidance that actually manifests itself as an eating disorder. So, So because of it, and because all of your friends tell you, and you know yourself, you don't eat very well, and you have been shaking, and you have been weak, and we spoke to you about, hey, maybe we need to go in and get you some tests, let's take a peek at, actually get a lot of lab tests, and we thought that maybe the ER would be the way to do it, because you had visited urgent care not so long ago with a similar idea, and how'd that work out?
Yeah, I went to urgent care, and they did some lab tests too, but they told me my lab levels were fine.
And urgent care, I would imagine that they wouldn't run a very comprehensive number of tests. They would just run, the difficult things you know for urgent care for. So I think one of the thoughts that we were talking about, in fact, I know one of the thoughts we're talking about, is if we went to the ER, perhaps they would be more comprehensive in what they were looking for, particularly if you spoke about the tremors. I mean, and I'm not, we're not talking about a little bit. I mean, it's the type of thing that you've actually spoken about, and the type of tremors you get with Parkinson's. So maybe neurological, which is, one of the things, if you're wondering how, is your lack of eating, how is it affecting your body, and is it affecting you in any really significant way?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I first experienced the tremoring of my legs, I thought, well, maybe I'm probably not getting enough protein because of the lack of it in my diet. But then I wondered, and my friend, my roommate, wanted to rule out something like MS or a neurological condition. And that did get ruled out. But I'm still shaking. I actually did go to a store and get a cane. And I think it's very embarrassing to have a cane because I'm still so young. I'm only 49. I mean, I'm not that young. And that I'm not that old either, but I shouldn't have a cane at age 49.
Just in case somebody is listening and saying, oh, I have a cane. I'm of this age. I'm younger than you. I have a cane. So this we'll put in the caveat that you're talking specifically about how you feel for yourself, and you're not projecting this upon the population as a whole. So you feel that at your age, you shouldn't. I'm sitting there trying to make excuses because there's somebody out there who's going to the cry offense, I would imagine, at this one. So now that I've stumbled ham-fistedly through a cover your ass segment, let's get back to now we went to the ER because you were getting worse.
Well, yeah. And when I first entered the ER, when you were with me that day.
Do we mention the hospital or do we leave them out of it? Because I think
we should leave it out.
The ground rule.
Leave it out.
Well, okay. Well, let's just discuss it just for a moment, because part of doing these things is giving information that is useful to other peers, but it's also a matter of community accountability. And so if we only speak about, and if we're trying to protect the medical facility, that shouldn't be a concern, because they could use this kind of feedback. And this would be a good way to get feedback that where there's accountability attached. But if we're trying to protect your medical records, then that's something different. So are we looking to protect your medical records, or are we looking to protect the facility? Andrew sides on the side of we're going to get sued at any moment. So
yeah, either.
Well, look, if we're just talking about your case and our experience, so you and I hanging out for 10 hours, then there's no problem there. There's no liability there. We're just speaking.
I would just rather describe my experience at this particular hospital, but I don't want to say the name.
Oh, right. So this particular experience you had at Presbyterian Hospital in Central in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
You just said it.
All right. So. Oh, did I say the quiet part out loud again? Oops. All right, let's go on. So we were at Presbyterian Hospital on Central here in Albuquerque. So you and I went in. We went in, I think, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday.
No, it wasn't Sunday. It was actually a Tuesday.
Right, yeah. Sunday. Okay, so we were there on Sunday. Oh, sure. Right. Yeah. No, so as you were saying, I agree with you. We were there on Sunday.
You're wrong. We were there on Tuesday, December 5th. I have my calendar.
I wish you would stop trying to tell me we were there on Sunday. I'm trying to tell you that we were there on Tuesday. Okay. Tuesday. Can we just move on? I'm tired of arguing. We were there on Tuesday.
So I go up there. To state, when I first go up to the administrative person or whoever that was, and she asked me, well, why are you here today, or what are your symptoms? And what did I say? I said, I'm shaking due to eating disorder. Did I say something like that?
You mentioned that you haven't been eating well at all. And you also mentioned that, You also mentioned that the shaking was becoming more prominent, and that things like when you went shopping, you would have to sit down while others were shopping because you were getting too weak to stand. So that's initially what you're talking about. You did mention that you believed it was inconsequential of not eating. So that's what you shared initially. Yes, you talked about, to be clarifying on this, you were talking about physical symptoms, physical manifestations for a physical reason that you weren't eating, and you were concerned about what it was doing to your body. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so we went there on medical pretense. We were there to look at a medical condition, and that's important because it's going to play into where this actually is going. So anyway, take it away.
And so at the beginning of the process at the ER, The
Presbyterian ER on Central in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yes. They put you in triage so that they can decide who they're going to call next out of the people who are waiting in the ER lobby. So initially, they labeled me something that was not a physical problem. They said that I had a behavioral problem.
Well, it
so
it's important to point out, though, I can't stress this enough, that you went in and you spoke about a medical issue, but at some point they got around to asking you about your mental health, and as soon as you went down with mental health, they decided to treat you as if you were there for a psychological reason and you were not there for a medical reason. And that wasn't entirely clear until we got back into the ER itself. So,
yeah.
But I mean, at this point, did you know that they had put you down as we'll find out, they put up on the board, it actually said, this is what they said you were in there for, behavioral problem.
I did not know. Right. Did you know?
I did not know either. And then we sat out, and after triage, we went back out to the waiting room. They did an EKG on you later. But you know, we were out there for about another 2.5+ hours waiting until they took you back to the ER. So at that point during triage, I had no idea that they had decided that you were there for a behavioral, as they put it, problem, and not there for the medical reason that you went in for.
Yeah.
Yeah. So both of us were unaware, I guess is the point. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So let's continue, because this is riveting. This is fascinating.
So we were sitting there for the whole time was like 9 hours, 9-10 hours, just waiting in the ER. And I was getting a, what do you call it? An infusion or a saline bag, or what do you call that?
An IV.
They had you on an IV drip with a saline.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's skipping ahead just a little bit though, because you did go back for an EKG while we were still in the waiting room, and then you came back out, and I think after the EKG it was like another hour before they said, hey, we got a bed for you in the ER. You can come back now. So so I wasn't there for the EKG because they said you're going to get naked, and it really creaked me out. So I went back out to the waiting room. I don't like that.
I know. They didn't make me go naked. They just put these little sensor things on my chest to check my heart.
All the same. I wasn't there. I wasn't around for this. So did you get any indication while they were doing the EKG, checking your heart? Did you get any indication that they had decided they were treating you for a behavioral problem? Or did you still assume that you were there for a medical reason?
I assumed I was there for a medical reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've had EKGs before.
What do you think it could have been that you said that might have directly led them to believe that they could, or they should have switched it to what they switched it to? Behavioral reason. Yeah.
They didn't want to put a physical reason why I was there. They thought it was a behavioral thing. Because maybe I shouldn't have said eating disorder when I first got there. I don't know.
I feel like that's a big part of it. Because if you're going in there, which, you know, at the time, the necessary thing was to get you, you know, hydrated and stable.
Stable.
Yes. And that's what, if that's the intention, I guess the idea would be that you want to keep the eating disorder element out of it as much as possible. If you knew that that's what they'd be searching out to try and triage you differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just harp on the fact that, you know, I'm not steady on my feet and I'm having tremors. And that's the thing that you should treat, not the fact that I'm, I mentioned the words eating disorder.
Yeah.
Precisely. So it wasn't until they took us back after your EKG, maybe an hour later, and they took you back to a gurney, at bed. Yeah. That's pretty crowded back there. We're really gonna have to talk about the guy who came in on shrooms, because we cannot not talk about the guy who came in on shrooms.
Oh right.
But and also, and I can't remember his name, so I'm just gonna call him Jimmy.
Okay.
Jimmy, who was so drugged up that he kept on trying to use one of the rooms as a restroom, and eventually he got his way.
Yeah.
Twice. So, but we'll get to that. So about an hour in, we'll just say an hour. So now it's probably getting close to like 8 o'clock-ish.
Yeah.
By the time we got back there and they sit you down. And they were really nice. We had the nice ginger nurse who was really cool. But we had somebody else prior to that. Oh God, this is hilarious. So you can't see Casey when we start talking about poo. Her face scrunches up like yeah, her face scrunches up yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very disturbing, but she looks both upset and mortally in danger when we talk about poop. But we get back in there, and it was right before shift change. And so there was a nurse we were talking to, and I was goofing. I was talking about poo. And so she started telling us about all sorts of ER poo stories, which was just wonderful. Did you enjoy, which one of her poo stories did you enjoy the most?
Wasn't her boyfriend a plumber or something?
No, don't skip ahead, because that's the next reveal, which is really, really cool. But her personal ER poo stories, which was your favorite?
I don't remember.
Good. Then I'll remind you of each one of them, shall I?
Hey, fine.
I'll choose my favorite poo story. My favorite poo story was where she was saying that, do you remember this one? Because this is great. You might have tuned out by now. That somebody very loose stooled upon the floor, and then they literally came running in for a code, and one of the doctors hit it, slid. We're talking like, you know, 1990s Seth Rogen movie. And hit the poo and fell and slid down the hall after running through some very liquidy stool that came out of another patient. That's a wonderful story.
It
almost sounds like it was make-believe, but I was there, you were there. And then the fun part, here's the reveal. You just said it. What did her boyfriend do? What is her boyfriend? What is his profession?
Plumber.
And that opened it up to a whole new universe. Hmm. Of poo stories. So she started telling his poo stories on top of her poo stories, and Casey loved every second of it.
Oh yes, I did, huh? Mm.
I close my eyes and envision that, and it's like Christmas morning. Every morning I think about your face looking like it's going to squunch up and implode on itself because of mm-hmm. poo story after poo story after poo story. And the unfortunate part is shift change came and she disappeared, as did all of her poo stories. So now we're back there and you could see it. You were facing the other way, but I was facing actually the desk. And then they have a big LCD screen, TV screen up mm-hmm. there, and it has your initials on it, and then has your age on it, and that's how they identify the different patients. And then it's like a, you know, the spreadsheet, and then there's information further down, a lot of it over on the right hand side that is actual useful information. But they do put the reason why you're there right, you know, dead center in the screen. Mm-hmm. And there were people like there who were saying abdomen pain, foreign object, headache, just, you know, just other things that they mm-hmm. put down. But for yours, and this is where I went grr Nash, and you know, grr hashtag Mondays, I hate them, behavioral problem.
Yeah.
Not eating disorder, not psychiatric need or anything. It actually said behavioral problem. And that's where I started slipping into crazy. I'm angry. I started getting, you know, actually kind of pissed off. Because this is something that happened, and this is the entire point of the discussion where we're going with this is it's a stigma. It is a medical stigma, and I have some things to share about this as to why it happens as such, but it is a stigmatization that you went in for the medical reason, and what they decided that they were treating you for was not the medical behavioral problem, and there's a reason why they do it like this. But how did that make you feel? Because you saw me, I was starting to get, you know, agitated when I told you about it. How did that make you feel?
Just like I was a nothing. Like,
did you feel dismissed then? Did you feel like they weren't listening to you?
Yeah. I mean, every person in the ER has a valid reason for being there, but I felt like, well, I was less than somebody who had a valid reason for being there.
So you felt that you were being invalidated?
Yeah.
Which is me just stating the obvious, because you said the word invalid several times now, and I decided to make it very, very succinct in saying, by putting you down as a behavioral problem, they invalidated you as a person.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt that way before, specifically?
Probably. I just felt like my problem was not worth treating or something for them.
Yeah.
But the reason,
Andrew?
just like the very specific feeling of somebody sort of trivializing what's going on with you, especially because there's no urgency to the problem. There's nothing dramatic or different about it. It's presenting in a regular way.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And trivializing, that's a really important way of putting it. We talked about, because it does, I mean, in one way, can sign you up or sign the medical facility up for a liability. So if you went in there for a medical reason and they triage you and they didn't really see anything that concerned them at that moment, but the reason why you went in there suddenly, maybe you just start seizuring, you're just not just shaking anymore. You're like a piece of bacon on the surface of the sun, kind of tremors. That's kind of funny. I'm gonna write that down. Like a piece of bacon on the surface of the sun. Not possible, but it's a wonderful image all the same. Anyway, not turkey bacon, because that's not real bacon, but that's a different thing.
Right.
There's that cake donut. Nope, not a thing. But if you were have manifested in some stronger way later, it sets them up for a liability that perhaps they don't want, they don't need, because they dismissed you. They dismissed why you came into the ER.
What you're getting into is the liability factor of any behavioral health issue, of course, what's associated with that.
Well, I mean, it's identifying us as something other. I mean, that's a stigma. Perhaps if you went in there with your hand cut off, somehow your hand was evolved from your body, they would, that they couldn't ignore it then, but they can ignore. I don't know. It feels like being ignored, being dismissed, being trivialized, and like with any stigma, this really is a stigma. It's a feeling of being devalued as a human being. I mean, because like Andrew, you've been through the ER to go inpatient for psych, as I have, and that's kind of, I don't know, it always feels dehumanizing having to talk about my mental health with people who are making judgments upon me based upon that. So, and even when I'm specifically there for psychiatric help and it's not for a medical reason, it still feels very dehumanizing, the type of questions that they ask and then how they probe at me. And that's a thing. So, I mean, you've been through a similar situation. You've been inpatient yourself. How did it make you feel going through the ER triage and the ER process?
I don't know. In a lot of ways, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. There are certain things they're doing that they have to kind of implement. The whole, have you thought about hurting yourself? Have you thought about hurting other people? Have you had any thoughts of suicide in the last 6 days? Blah, 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 blah. Do you have a plan to kill yourself? Those kinds of things. If you're suicidal, obviously that's important, but a lot of times that doesn't solve the problem by just asking people straight out. But also that kind of thing, it very clearly indicates that this is the gloves we're handling you with. I see that when Casey gets labeled with that, and they're probably thinking, because it's a behavioral health issue, they have to treat it in the same realm of like, well, she might be suicidal or this, that, or the other that associates with the behavioral health issues and liability.
The intake questions that you asked there, Andrew, do you feel like hurting yourself? Do you feel like hurting others? Do you feel like killing yourself? Do you have a plan to kill yourself? And that's a different topic altogether, but we're going to come back to it at some point, because those questions are ludicrous. As I feel it, if I'm going into the ER thinking I need to go inpatient because I feel like, and they ask me these questions and they say, well, you're not bad enough to go into the hospital. If I took myself to the hospital, I definitely need to be inpatient. Your questions are ludicrous. But anyway, going back to this stigma that we're chatting about, is that, I never liked it when I didn't like it when I saw it. Heart on the sleeve, of course, always, that they took my friend, Casey, and reduced you to, it's all in your head.
Yeah.
Effectively, that's what it came down to. They just said, it's all in your head. And
both my head and my body, obviously. That's hurting because I'm not feeding myself that I'm crazy or something.
Sure.
I don't know.
If, But yeah, I think as Andrew said, it really doesn't matter if you're going in there for a medical condition. It doesn't matter how you got yourself there in the medical condition. It's the actual medical condition that is needing treatment, not the brain at that moment. Mm. And there's a reason why this is done, and why I wanted to talk to Casey come now sort of talk about this is something that in years past, when I was on far too many committees, that mental health committee as a peer advisor, this is something that I had talked to UNM ER staff about. I had talked to a great number of people about this, that it really stinks when we come in for a medical reason, but you decide that we need to be treated for the mental health because they can't be exclusive of each other.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not exclusive of each other. That the brain is the reason why everything else is happening and why we're there. And so this is a stigma that I've been looking at for better than 10 years now. I'm not the only peer who's noticed this through the years. But this is, this one strikes home because I was there for 10 hours with one of my very best friends. Mm-hmm. And for a very specific reason that we had all talked about before you going there with really looking for help for you going forward on the medical side, and it wasn't provided. Well, should we chat? I mean, I really do want to talk about the guy who came in on shrooms. You tell the story, and I'll fill in the color. So, Andrew, did we tell you about the guy who came in on shrooms? Is this new to you? Because I have to believe that we talked about this because it was so freaking funny.
I remember the one-liner that he ended up saying. I do remember that part. Said no man ever is what you said, but he said something else.
Okay, yeah. Well, he came in, and he wasn't as delightful as he thought he was.
And every other word out of his mouth was the F word, yelling at the staff and other patients in the ER.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. He started out just as cantankerous and then a little belligerent, and then mm-hmm. he started saying some pretty vicious things, and then it escalated. But yes, every other word. But it got to the point where he was escalating enough that they had security come hold him down, and they had to put soft restraints on him. Yeah. And the guy was lucid enough that he was trying to be manipulative, which was just insane. How much did he take? Ginger Nurse, what did she tell us? Three ounces?
Like 1 ounce.
1 ounce of shrooms. Now, I have not done shrooms, and Andrew, we've talked to you about this, and you seem to have a little bit more knowledge of how much 1 ounce of shrooms, how that would affect a person. Or was I talking to Matt about that?
I think it might have been Matt, but I am pretty sure it's a lot.
The only shrooms I know are about the microdosing that the British have been doing to treat depression, a novel way to treat depression. So, but that's microdosing, and I'm kind of guessing that 1 ounce is not a microdose.
Yeah, that's a bit more. Yeah, quite. There's a certain level called the heroic dose that just full blown, puts you into a different dimension, and I'm sure he was above that.
Yeah, so he got more and more colorful as mm-hmm. and then I think the most colorful part about it though is once they had him restrained. Okay, two colorful parts is first one was he was now threatening to kill people, that he was taking mental notes of people's badges and such, and he's gonna track them down and kill not only them, but he specifically zeroed in on cats, and he took a poll of everybody on the floor and asked who has a cat, and then he started taking down their names specifically. He says, okay, not only am I gonna kill you, I'm going to leave here and I'm going to kill your cat. And I had mixed feelings at that point. Is this guy a good guy? Is he a bad guy? I'm not certain. Now
you always have to make it about the cats, don't you?
What's that?
You always have to make it about the cats because you hate cats.
I don't hate cats. I nothing cats. Although I am still coughing some 1 month later because I helped a friend move her furniture and I was in her house for about an hour and I'm still hacking up lung boosters because of a cat. No animal should have this sort of physical power over me simply by existing. Okay, anyhow, so he got more colorful, but then he decided to try to manipulate his way out of the restraints. And Casey, what did he bring up, so to speak? to manipulate his way out of the restraints.
He had to pee or something about his penis or something?
Well, yeah, he needed, he was saying that he needed to urinate, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then, you know, but then, the, of course, the conversation turned to his penis, which just got all the more entertaining.
Yes.
He was, so they wouldn't undo him. He was trying to manipulate his way out. And so if you need to pee, they had one of those pitchers, the pee pitchers.
Yeah.
That they got. And they're going to him. And he started saying very loudly, "Take your hands off my penis."
To which Steve replied, said, "No man ever."
We were there for about 8 or 9 hours at this point.
Yeah.
Casey and I were both a little bit punchy at that point.
Yeah.
And comfortable. And the quiet part came out. And there was a little bit of rumble of laughter at that one, which, you know, it was good. Because, you know, just in this tumultuous and stressful situation, a little joy peeked its way through. Well, eventually they ended up just wheeling him into a room. It's like, okay, well, you know, go in there and complain all to your heart. So they just wheeled him into a room and pulled the curtain. But it sounded to me a little bit like when we were talking to Ginger, it's a guy was a frequent flyer. They saw him with some regularity for just this. So it wasn't anything really new.
Well, now I know if I want to meet new people and get my penis touched, I just need to take more than an ounce of mushrooms and head on down to
and the hospital. And that is the takeaway. All right, let's just go. Well, thanks for tuning in tonight, guys. That's the takeaway. We're done.
We're back. Get more to talk about stigmas of mental health in the triage of the emergency room at
the Presbyterian Hospital in Central in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I have no trouble speaking about this, guys, because again, it's a matter of accountability. I've spoken to them in years past about this several times. I've spoken to people who should be able to do something about this, and they never have. And then it continues, troubles me, that they put down behavioral health problem. And I'm going to tell you something, though, now that we're back in on this, and this is the final comment I'm going to make on the matter. They know about this, and it's done purposely so. Putting down behavioral problem, it betrays a little bit that they don't really think of this as something that they handle within the medical ER. It's a problem that belongs to behavioral. I'm going around in circles, but it reveals something about it, how they put it down as a problem and not a diagnosis or an issue or a concern or something for treatment. It was a problem to be literally turfed off the psychiatric. And the reason for this, as I've been told a few times from a few different people who spoke to me, not so much on anonymity, but mostly like, hey, Steve, you should know this about this so that you have this information you can share with your friends. There's a liability issue. If somebody comes in with a behavioral health problem, and something happens, medical doesn't feel that they are covered. And the medical ER does not feel that they're covered in terms of, so they want to, in terms of liability in case this behavioral health problem, it manifests itself as something that is harmful. Whether somebody else gets hurt, they hurt themselves, suicide, what have you, they don't want to take the responsibility for it. And so they'll turf it off. They'll get a psych eval, is what they call it. So they'll go through all the motions, get a psych eval, and then once the psych eval happens, that is now the liability of the psych department, and they're off the hook. And that might be a crass way of putting it, or a simplistic way of putting it, but it is a pretty simple stigma. It is a pretty simple policy. And it does exist. So, Casey's experience allowed us to highlight that, to bring it up. And it's troublesome that it still exists, but I don't know how you systemically change that at this point. I don't really know how. And that's a topic all unto itself, of the idea of, rather than treating from the neck up as one department and the neck down as a different department, but actually have those two integrated, because come on, how is your brain separate from your body? That's a really huge push now in the medical field, is to integrate that once and for all and finally and treat it as a whole rather than two parts of the body that are separate from each other. So how did that make you feel? How do you guys feel about it, you think? Now that you know a little dirty secret, what do you think?
think I got to be real careful about how I present what issue I want addressed, because it could be, I could mention that I have bipolar and that I'm in distress, but if I have other things going on, like, I don't know, let's say I just consumed too many mushrooms, that may be a little bit of a gray area there. I don't know. I probably should consult a medical professional about that. But yeah, I want to make sure that certain things are not emphasized and that my issue that I'm coming in for is, I mean, I'm glad that Casey ended up getting on an IV. I don't know what else they did about just trying to get her more on her feet, because, you know, when the issue is just a calorie deficit, there are certain things they can do, I'm sure. I don't know. What have they done in the past for you, Casey?
Well, that was the first time that I went to the ER for, I mean, I've been to the urgent care for this issue, for the shaking. But they didn't actually say that it was hypokalemia, which is a low potassium.
Which is one of the test results that you have was hypokalemia?
That was the test result from this emergency visit.
Well, it's one test result. Now, actually, we need to actually fully express what would be. My mom died of a very rare blood disorder, bone marrow disease. And so I got used to looking at labs that had to do a lot with blood and blood tests, and particularly blood tests on particular cells. And I will say that when Ginger Nurse came back to us and said, okay, well, you know, we've got this, these are the tests we're waiting on before we discharge you. They actually looked at a lot of stuff. It really looked like they were looking at anemia, but they looked at a lot more of your blood panel than I think they typically would had you not mentioned that you were undernourished. And so they didn't completely dismiss you. And I think that's an important point to make, an incredibly important point to make. They ran more tests on your blood than I think they would have otherwise. And so they weren't negligent to the point of they didn't do any work at all. But I do think they misidentified while you were there. But they did run a lot more on your blood than I expected them to do. I recognize a lot of the tests that they were talking about and stuff that they were running on my mom. So they did do their job. We should actually be very clear that they did their job based upon what you came and talked about. But yeah, hypokalemia. And I've spoken to you guys about this before. I've talked to providers about this before. Low potassium can do weird things to you. I mean, when I have had hypokalemia, I don't get paralyzed, but my muscles won't respond. I'll drop. I'll drop stuff. I can't talk. I'll fall down because my muscles just stop responding. They just don't respond. Not paralysis, but lack of response. You get the shaking. But I think one of the more terrifying things is that hypokalemia, just low potassium, can cause psychosis. And I found my way into Haven Behavioral Hospital one time when my potassium dropped because I got psychotically paranoid in a way that I never had before. And that's, again, another podcast for another time. But hypokalemia for you,
it's because I'm malnourished and not getting the things that I need.
Have you been better about drinking the electrolyte stuff lately?
Yeah, I was going to ask. That's a good source of potassium, to be honest.
I have been drinking it more recently, but today I was so busy that I couldn't do it. I was filling out the forms for a medical thing that I'm doing on Friday.
Hey, you want to hear something cool? I'm drinking fluid as we do this podcast. I bet you could do the same.
I have some right here. I have some. Well, yeah.
Make it disappear. Have you gone in for any blood tests since we went to the ER? Have you had your potassium checked?
No, not since then. But I have a follow-up phone appointment with my regular doctor in a couple days on Thursday.
Okay, good. Well,
she might want me to get some more blood work done.
Yeah. Well, I would almost insist upon it because
Yeah.
And what's the point otherwise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. So are we done talking about poop? Or can we go back to talking about poop?
I say we go back to it. It's fascinating. Scatology.
Yeah, just you guys ever put it between your hands and either rub it in like some Jergens or roll it around like a piece of paste and make a cute little ball out of it? And is that just me?
Only reason I do that is if it was to get the coffee bean that a civet had eaten, so that I could try that ultra rare poop coffee that people talk about.
I've heard that, yes.
Whoa, I have not heard this.
You haven't heard about this? These civets,
no, I haven't heard this. Tell me this.
I don't know what it is. Sri Lanka, somewhere in the coffee belt, Southeast Asia, maybe. There's certain types of coffee beans that are specifically harvested from the scat of civets, or I think that's what they're called.
Yeah.
And they they only eat the certain kind of coffee beans, and they're really picky about which ones they eat, which is why when they end up pooping them out, it's kind of it's a coveted type of coffee to have. Now, what's interesting is it's actually started as, you know, when the coffee empire started going off, for the most part, from what I can remember, they took all the coffee beans and the locals couldn't have any coffee because all of that coffee went to the coffee trade. But they were allowed to collect the shit, the coffee from the civets, and make their coffee with that. And they did find that it had a certain flavor, certain je ne sais quoi, and then it caught on and turned into like a luxury kind of coffee because it was hard to find in the sense that you had to find it from the shit of civets.
And civets, what is a civet?
Some kind of cat.
It's a kind of cat rodent. I don't know.
C-E-V-A-T? C-E-V-A-T?
C-I-V-E-T?
Yeah, C-I-V-E-T.
Okay. Well, then that sounds great because one of my favorite things to do is dig through cat food.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
No, I from what it looks like, it it's the African, I don't know, certain places in Southeast Asia, but it's like a raccoon-looking little cat.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Delicious.
But they like the coffee.
This sounds like a very hipster thing.
Yes, and one of these days maybe I'll try it, but I don't know. That's the only reason I would go through some poop, or if I like left my wedding ring in some child's diarrhea, like a Dr. House.
Why would your wedding ring be? Okay, that
okay.
There's too much to unpack there. You bring children into it and diarrhea, and suddenly I'm going, Andrew, I don't really want to know too much about your personal life anymore.
Well, you know, I'm referencing a Dr. House episode. That he like takes care of Cuddy's child for a little bit. Something happens to I don't know, is a dime in the kid's poop, and they are like constantly straining and monitoring its poop. And then they eventually don't find it, but Cuddy does. Anyways, that's what I'm going with.
Scrubs had to deal with this. Christopher Turk, the surgeon, a kid, a recurring character named Ralphie. Swallowed the engagement ring that he was going to give to Carla, and so he was monitoring Ralphie to see, okay, when you shit, you got to come in and tell me. And like he's telling this to Ralphie because he's trying to keep it quiet. He doesn't want people to know that so he's trying to just talk to the kid exclusively, and he's going, just imagine, it's like little men trying to push it out, Ralphie, and like the dads are going, what the hell's wrong with you? You're talking to my kid about his poop and little man, you're gonna give him nightmares. Yeah, so not a dime, but an actual ring, a wedding ring, Andrew. You were using the wrong pop culture reference there. If we go back to the early 2000s, you chose the wrong show for your pop culture reference.
I don't know, I think House is better, sorry.
Hey, you know, I'm a big fan of any show that has a misanthropic but good-hearted doctor. Scrubs, Becker, House.
Yeah, that's a pretty common theme. I think you'd like to see that. As long as he like saves the lives in the end, it's okay. Yeah. Which is how he's able to get away with so much.
That's right. Casey, thank you for sharing as much as you did about your condition and our fun night at that 10 hours of
It's good to be frank about that.
It's good because what we share here, when we actually share of ourselves, it makes it easier for other people to talk about it as well. And it also gives a lot of information that maybe people don't have otherwise. Mm-hmm. So,
like, not a lot of people even know about ARFID.
Yeah.
Exactly. And do you want to, once again, do you want to break down that acronym?
Yeah, ARFID is a eating disorder that stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder.
And it's also the butler to Batman.
The Christmas time sadness, the flip side of the Christmas. Yeah. A lot of us have had issues with getting in the spirit for Christmas. Of course, when you're a kid and you still believe in Santa, for better or for worse, you get into the season's spirit so much easier because there's this expectation you're going to get that thing you wanted. And, you know, you get older, that joy and magic fades away and it turns into anxiety. It turns into, for a lot of people, it's like finals week for midterms and all kinds of stuff just creeps in that's really negative. And of course, seasonal affective disorder is worse at this time of year because the sun is just nowhere to be found most of the day. You wake up and it's dark, you come home from work and it's dark. The Christmas season just has so many dark sides of it that maybe we just made the holiday to cope with it. I don't know.
Well, wouldn't necessarily say that everything is dark about it. I will say that my mom passed away, in 2011, and Christmases have not been the same because she was the one who made Christmas happen. I remember it's different now, of course, as I got older. You know, when I had my kid, of course, even when I was not doing well, I always try to make something happen for my kid that was fun. And enjoyable nature that he had good Christmases as well. But I don't know. I wouldn't really look at Christmas as a negative thing, but it's definitely one of those things that people like to share this feel about what are you grateful for? And the holidays tend to drag that particular not trope. What is the word I'm looking for? This is a good time of year to reflect upon what you're grateful for, which I think for a lot of people who do have depression, particularly seasonal affective disorder, if they have something else going on in their life, they're trying to dig out this grateful stuff is a little bit more difficult, and it's not quite so helpful as people might think to say you'll feel better if you just list the things that you're grateful for. You know, that said, I am grateful for being alive, and I'm grateful for sucking at suicide, and the proof that I have of sucking at suicide is I'm here talking to you guys right now. But it can be difficult. I think for a lot of people with mental health issues, that the holidays sometimes exacerbate symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what good. Casey, you usually have a real strong opinion about this because you have a real reason that the holidays are tough for you every year.
Well, yeah. Both my parents have passed away. My mom passed away in 2007. My dad passed away in 2016. So I just feel, I don't know, like I'm a lost kid without my parents at around the holidays. And so it's been very difficult because I miss them terribly. My other relatives are around the country, but mostly back home where I come from in Wisconsin. And my brother and I are not that close. And I just feel kind of alone. I don't have the Christmas spirit like I did when I was a younger kid. But I do remember when I was a kid and it was happy. Yeah. And I did the presents and I did have the family around. So I have good memories of Christmases when I was a kid.
Tell me one. Tell me one of those wonderful memories.
On my mom's side of the family, we had two sets of grandma and grandpas because my mom's family had divorced and remarried when she was young. So there was just a lot of people and presents and cousins to see around Christmas time and the holidays. So that's a good memory.
Yeah. What was your favorite? What was your favorite present as a kid? I agree. Legos are the best. Legos are the absolute best present ever. So I agree with you.
Legos. Oh. I liked my Light Bright.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
Little pegs in the...
Little pegs. I loved the Light Bright. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not well known, but Light Bright was the inspiration for Grand Theft Auto.
Where do you extrapolate that? That's a real long stretch.
Oh, well, they're both visual entertainment. So obviously, one is the Light Bright is the precursor to Grand Theft
Auto. It's like a zoomed in, frame by frame version of a video game. In a roundabout. Yeah. Okay. I can see that.
Precisely. Yeah. So the Light Bright. Checks out. Do you still have it? What do you guys end up doing with your childhood toys? Where are they?
I have some of mine in a little suitcase somewhere. A couple action figures. I don't know. Swords. Small stuff. I really liked... this really cool pliers combination Swiss Army knife my dad got for me when I was 10. That's something that I really hope I can keep forever, because I'm happy to have that. It's not a toy though.
Well,
so Blackberry, what else?
I have my sticker book still from when I was a kid. But that wasn't necessarily a Christmas present, but I still have my sticker book from when I was in elementary school.
Did you ever have the Scratch and Sniff stickers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are your stickers still sticky?
Some of them. Once in a while, I'll look in there and they're slightly still sticky, but that was from like 40 years ago. I mean, 30, 40 years ago.
Cool.
And I feel old.
Are these sparkly? Because then your sparkly stickers would be slightly still sticky.
Some of them are sparkly still.
my proctologist used to give, you know, scratch and sniff stickers when you left the office. You went in there for your annual proctology exam, and I don't know, they always smelled like corn. They weren't, you know, real fragrant, but the proctologist, all of his scratch and sniff stickers that he would give out to the kids smelled like corn.
It's corn.
Or coffee. Or coffee. Mm. Yeah. So it's rough, Casey. You have the difficulty, yeah. And you know, so what do you do? I mean, how do you get through the holidays? Can you enjoy the holidays? Like, do you find anything enjoyable about them now?
It's the last few years have been very hard.
Yeah. And what do you do for yourself to get yourself through it?
I just try to think of the happy memories of when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I would say that the reason that most of the time you end up having a good Christmas is because you are around other people. And that's the biggest reason for me. I mean, the happiest Christmases were the ones where I saw all the family, did all the things together, and everybody was there. You got to see everybody. That's obviously, you know, you could get all sappy about it, talk about how it's just like the spirit and the magic of Christmas. But it's true. And that's probably what makes it the memory so good, is because you had your family, you had people giving you stuff and looking out for you and taking care of you and acknowledging you in a way that, you know, that made you feel special. And that's what's awesome about it. I think having somebody to pass that down to made a huge difference to me. Otherwise, Christmas is just another, like, all right, I'll show you what you got. My son is, he's really special. It's at this point in time in his life, it's a big deal. It's It's How still, old is he? He's eight, and that's like prime kid time. And that's just going to be the best thing ever watching that happen, even though he will start turning into that kid that's like, this is not the game that I wanted. You know, this kind of consumerist capitalist boy that sees Christmas as something else than it should be. But
oh, don't count him out yet. He's a sweet kid.
He's super sweet, and I hope he stays that way forever, never. But it's just that you realize that that's what it is. It's family.
Family.
Yeah. Well, I have a small family. I never had extended family really around for the holidays. Between my sister and my mom, my dad, and of course my kid came along, and I was married for a short while. Well, actually not a short while. I was married for a decade. That too. You know, last time I saw her, yeah, I think it was right around Christmas time. It was the last time I saw the ex, and she was at the gates of hell in the midst of a hostile takeover. So that's how I remember her mostly now. But with my kid, yeah, absolutely. Having my son really made it actually got me to where I wanted to take part in Christmas, even though a lot of the times I was so severely depressed with the bipolar depression and such. And of course, I miss the sunlight. My body misses the sunlight. My brain misses the sunlight big time. So holidays are a little bit rough. But then, you know, just kind of my kid's up in Seattle now. I won't be seeing him this Christmas, unfortunately. I'll be seeing my dad going out to California here in a few. I really enjoy doing that, but as I got older, holidays change. I'll tell you, one of the hardest things, guys, was a number of years ago. It was soon after my kid moved out. I actually woke up in my house alone for the first time. I had friends coming over later in the afternoon, but I woke up Christmas morning entirely on my own. And I just woke up and I started crying my eyes out. It was such a horrible feeling to actually have woken up in a house by myself on Christmas. I didn't like that at all. That was a shitty feeling. But it's happened a few times since then, just because of logistics. And that first time really knocked me off my feet, though. But I learned how to deal with that. And I don't get so excited about the holidays anymore, but it is, I could actually, thankfully, gratefully, I could feel Christmas spirit now. You know, I can go and see Christmas trees, and you know, like Casey and I, when we were coming back from the group last night, we drove through Old Town just so I could see the Christmas lights down there in Old Town, Albuquerque, and that actually I felt the little perkiness of the Christmas spirit. We had some lights and stuff down there, and that felt pretty good. I think that more than anything is something we're talking about gratitude. We're playing the gratitude game. I feel a grand amount of gratitude that I can actually feel holiday spirit, whereas for a great number of years, I didn't know how to ever feel it again. I'll tell you, one of my favorite things about Christmas was not so much a present and such. My mom made this Jell-O salad, a colloidal thing. So she put whipped cream in, it had to be black cherry Jell-O with the fruit cocktail, canned fruit cocktail, and marshmallows. And she made this every year. That was Christmas for me. That was always a huge part of Christmas, was that I get Christmas dinner. And it was really sweet. After my dad passed away, my dad tried to make it for me because he knew. I mean, I was, oh, yeah, the rest of the pan's mine. You guys got your one piece, the rest of it. And he tried to make it for me. It was a soggy, sloppy, soupy mess. But my dad actually tried doing that for me, which is really cool. Really, really cool that my dad made the effort. I told him, don't try to make the effort again. But it was really sweet for him to do that first Christmas after my mom passed.
Yeah.
I mean, if you guys were going to try to drag out something of gratitude, even though it's tough, I mean, is that one of the things that you can think of, something that you're really grateful for? I mean, like, having good memories is something to be grateful for.
That's true. So
if you were to play the game, what is one thing that you like about the holidays now?
I mean, for me, it's 100% family, or you know, food. That's second. A lot of times, it's like you're saying with the Jell-O. There are certain things that, like, my grandma, my grandparents would make tamales every year, and we figured out how to get my grandpa's recipe together, and we did it, and we've been doing it since, and it's still kind of Like, that's one thing that I see is like keeping alive, you know, that feeling of like, yeah, it's not my grandpa's, but it's my grandpa's tamales. And there you go. That's tradition. That's the meaning. Finding, I think the meaning is the biggest reason, which is, you know, you want to talk about the religious aspect of it. That's what a lot of people resound back to is it's got this feeling of like, we're all awaiting and hoping that something is going to come along. And that feeling is like embedded in the whole act of Christmas itself. And that's what makes it so hard when it's a letdown, when you wake up on Christmas morning and it's like, this is it. That's all. But yeah, being around people is like 100% so much better than experiencing it by yourself.
Yeah, and I've been in Albuquerque for 20 years, and there have been a few times when I went back home to Wisconsin for Christmas or to California to my brother's house for Christmas, and I feel much better being with the family than being alone in my house or apartment, because I felt very lonely without a Christmas tree. But I didn't have the effort or the motivation to set up any decorations when I was alone. And I still don't really have the motivation this year or last year. The only real Christmas, I guess, in Albuquerque that I had was like in 2020 when we actually had a Christmas tree and people at my house. But that was like very chaotic at the same time. But I was glad there were people there.
Yeah, yeah. Family. You know, I'm sitting here with a couple of Catholics. So absolutely, the religious aspect is a huge part of the holiday. The reason for the season, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can get to a game that we're going to play here. But I really wish everybody out there has somebody for themselves this holiday season. Because Andrew and I were trying to figure out how we're supposed to close off these silly things, because we end up talking. And so we actually have a closer for the show now. So this game that we just decided, it was called Two Lists, and now I'm going to call it Either Or. This is how we close our shows. So I have two lists of people here. All right? There are 10 people total. All right? 10 people total on each list, two different lists. And you must tell me. Now, see, I've been watching a lot of movies lately, and it seems to me that Hollywood has gone to the powerful, independent woman. Is a type of character in Star Wars now, the powerful female character, powerful women. And so I've created a list of two groups of powerful women, and you must tell me, are they a congressional representative in the House, the House of Representatives, or Congress here in the United States, or is the person a female serial killer? So two groups of very powerful women. And you must tell me, is it a congressperson, a congresswoman, or serial killer? You guys ready? Melanie Stansbury.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, congresswoman, 100%.
All right. I thought we'd go ahead and start here in New Mexico. I was hoping to trip you guys up on this and make sure. So, yes, Melanie Stansbury is a congresswoman from here in New Mexico.
Level one, right there. Yeah.
Okay. So. Julia Brownlee, serial killer or congresswoman?
I guess Congress.
You guys get 5 seconds, otherwise you're going to be on
serial killer.
Congresswoman.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and keep score here. Oh, there's no score. No, Julia Brownlee is a congresswoman from California. Oh. California. Congress from California. All right. Rhonda Bell Martin.
Serial killer.
That is a serial killer. Right. And she is famous for a type of serial killing called family annihilation. She poisoned everybody. So Rhonda Bell Martin, that was serial killer.
That's an innovation right there.
So yes, okay, so okay, there it is. All right, so moving on. Lydia Sherman.
Or a serial killer.
That's giving off the vibe of a serial killer, but
That is a serial killer. Yes, Lydia Sherman is a serial killer. All right. Velma Barfield, congresswoman or serial killer? 5 seconds.
Sounds like she's congresswoman from Nebraska or something. Barfield.
No. Velma Barfield is actually a serial killer, and she has a distinction of being the first woman in American history to die by lethal injection.
Wow.
So. come on. My pen is running out. Sorry, I'm going to find another pen. I got to scratch these out because otherwise I'm not going to be able to keep track. Okay, so Velma Barfield, yes, that's a serial killer. She died, first woman to die by lethal injection in the United States. Yvette Clark.
Congresswoman.
Casey?
Congresswoman.
Congresswoman.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a congresswoman. She is from New York. Congresswoman from New York. Nancy Pelosi.
100% insider trading profiteer.
Oh, that's a trick question. Let's move on.
Yeah. Yeah, now that one's easy.
I won't say how that is a trick question, but I'm not insinuating anything. Nancy Pelosi, trick question. All right. Lizzie Fletcher.
That's serial killer.
How do you feel about that, Casey? Lizzie Fletcher.
Serial killer.
No, that is, I'll go ahead and email her. That's a congresswoman from Texas. Congresswoman from Texas.
Okay.
All right. Constance Fisher.
Constance Fisher. Sounds like a Mennonite serial killer. Sorry. But yeah, that's I'm just going to say serial killer.
Yeah, Constance Fisher is a serial killer. And this is a really sad one. And I put it in here. Definitely someone who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, it killed a number of her children, got sent to a mental health institution, was released, killed a few more of her children, then went to prison. So that's a sad one. Yeah, happy holidays, everyone. Okay, so Lizzie Halliday.
Lizzie Halliday.
Is that a serial killer or am I trying to fool you? Is that a congresswoman or a serial killer? 5 seconds.
Vote for Lizzie Halliday, West Virginia State Senate. Yeah, let's go with Senator.
Congresswoman, I didn't do any senators.
Oh, sorry.
No. Lizzie Fletcher was a congresswoman, but Lizzie Halliday is actually a serial killer, and she has a distinction of being the first woman to be executed by electric chair in the United States. So Lizzie Halliday was shocked to death. All right, next one. Lisa Blunt Rochester. Serial killer or congresswoman? 5 seconds.
Serial killer.
Okay, yeah.
I will go ahead and let our congresswoman from Delaware know that you guys think that she kills people. Lisa Blunt Rochester is... The first time we did this, it was Christian televangelist or gay porn star. So you probably... Okay, Mary Cowan.
That's serial killer.
Definitely serial killer. Yeah. She is known as the Borgia of Maine. It turned out a lot of, I picked a lot of people who were actually from the late 1800s, early 1900s when it comes to the serial killer women. Otherwise, it could be triggering to someone who knows more. Anyway, a lot of these people from the 1800s and into the 1900s, the women who liked to kill people, they used poison a lot. They responded using poison to kill people. All right. Mary Petola.
It doesn't sound like an all-American name. I don't know. It doesn't sound like... Okay, yeah.
Killer? No, that's actually... Mary Petola is a congresswoman from Alaska. Alaska. Oh. She does a lot of really good things for the indigenous people. I'm going to let you know. I'm taking notes, and I'm going to let each of these people, each of these congresswomen, know that you think that they just by the sound of their name, and you're very judgy and.
I'm sorry. That was some kind of ism. I'm sorry.
Okay, Vicky Carson Jackson. Vicky Carson Jackson. Anyone?
That just sounds like a Midwest senator, congresswoman's name. Yeah.
How about you, Casey?
Serial killer.
Casey got it. Vicky Carson Jackson is definitely a serial killer. Okay, Jennifer McClellan. Jennifer McClellan.
Congresswoman.
Yep. Congresswoman for Virginia. I'm going to let her know that you don't think she's a serial killer. Okay. Gwen Moore. Serial killer or congresswoman?
How do you spell the Moore? Because that makes all the difference to me.
Moore.
Oh, yeah. Serial killer.
Oh, definitely a serial killer. In fact, she's a serial killer from Wisconsin. But actually, she is a congresswoman.
Oh, she just moonlights as a serial killer. Yeah.
All right. Martha Wise.
What do you think, Casey?
Serial killer.
That is definitely a serial killer. I believe this is one of several nurses I put on here. There are several nurses who were very fond of killing their patients. Moving on. Okay. How about Kristen Gilbert. Serial killer, or are we looking at a congresswoman here?
Congresswoman.
You certain of that? Congresswoman?
Congresswoman.
What about you, Casey, are you sure?
Congresswoman.
Okay, you're both really close, but no, it's a serial killer. No, Kristen Gilbert, in fact, I think this is the woman. She is a nurse who was convicted of killing four patients, and she put the epinephrine into people with heart conditions, which is adrenaline, and which is difficult to trace. But one of the ways I believe that they got her is that she started working at this hospital, I believe in Texas, in the late 80s, and in her time from when she started until when she was finally arrested and let go, of the 350 emergency code. In fact, she would code them and then save them. I guess she didn't do it that great, because of the 350, she was around for like 140 of them. And the DA said that the chances of her being there for so many of these codes was like 1 in 100 million. Yes. So Kristen Gilbert, no, she does not make laws. She makes dead people. Charisse David.
Serial killer.
Casey, you agree?
I agree. Serial killer.
Okay, I'm gonna let our congresswoman from Kansas let you know. I'm gonna let her know that you think that she murders people. All right, final one, guys. All right, this is for all the points. Anna Marie Hahn. Serial killer or congresswoman? Powerful woman, both.
Power to kill. But,
In what way does this powerful woman exercise her power?
Congresswoman.
Yeah. But Casey says serial killer. Well, all the points go to Casey. Anna Marie Hahn is our final serial killer. So how did you guys do? I didn't bother to keep score. Thanks for tuning in. So. What are we calling this, Andrew? Either or? I think we just call it either or.
Either or.
Yeah. So did you guys enjoy that game? Was that fun for you?
Yeah. You had me on my toes.
I guess what we're going to do with our, we have a podcast coming up with a couple of my British madness friends. And I was thinking about doing internal parasite or food. A variety of food that you get from around the Ionian Sea. So internal parasite or delectable food from the Ionian Sea. That's the list that's being put together for them.
Names are the hardest, but I don't know. We'll see how that works for I.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, thanks for playing along. Okay. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas, everybody.
And to all a good night.
To all a good night. Oh, anybody got a good joke to leave us off with? Who's got a good joke? Anyone? Right,
I've got a really bad corny one, but.
Okay, let's hear it.
Papa Tomato and Kid Tomato were walking around, and Kid Tomato kept lagging behind, and Papa Tomato kept asking his son to stay behind him. Finally, Papa Tomato got really angry and just smashed poor Kid Tomato into the ground and said, "Ketchup."
Ooh.
Oh.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, that was painful. We have to give it to him, Casey. He's got an 8-year-old boy.
Yeah.
We have to let him have this one without murdering him. All right. Well, good evening, guys. We'll talk again soon. So if I don't talk to you beforehand, Merry Christmas. And if I don't talk to you beforehand, I'll see you guys next year.
Okay. Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Right on.
Night, guys.
Good night, all.